The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
51551 for texts. We're joined in studio by Mitch Albom, and people will know Mitch from, I suppose, his best known book is Tuesdays with Murray, but he's written loads more after that. Tuesdays with Murray, as I've said, is the best selling memoir ever. Not it. That's a claim to fame. So you've steered away from non-fiction for the last 10 years, and now you've published Finding Chica, which is a very personal story because it's very much about you. Murray was an acquaintance, whereas Chica was a member of your family.
Yeah, in some ways, I kind of see this book as a companion piece to Tuesdays with Murray, because back in 1995, I was sitting with, he was more than an acquaintance. I mean, I had him for 4 years as a college professor, and we were very, very close in college. Then I lost touch with him. And then when I found out that he was dying from motor neuron disease, I went started visiting him every Tuesday and kind of got this last class in what's important in life once someone knows they're going to die. 20-some years later, I found myself in a similar kind of class, only the teacher was a five-year-old girl, an orphan from our orphanage in Haiti, and she was hit with a terminal illness. But during the 2 years that we had together as our daughter, she taught us more than probably the 50-plus years that had preceded it.
Mm. So let's talk about the orphanage first, because that's where Chica came from.
Right.
So you interviewed this man, John Hearn. Was it after the Haiti earthquake?
It was 2 days after the terrible earthquake of 2010.
Yeah. And tell us about John Hearn.
Well, he was just a local pastor in Detroit, and he came to me because I also do a radio program there, as you do here. And he said he had an orphanage that he had been operating in Port-au-Prince, and he thought it had been destroyed, but there was no way to get a phone call in. And he was just hearing rumors, and could I help in some way? And just the idea of like kids somehow being buried under rubble and nobody looking for them because they don't know, I couldn't get out of my mind. So I helped put together a little trip with a small airplane, and I knew a senator in the United States who was from my area, and he was on the Armed Forces Commission. So they cleared a 10-minute window for us to land. We had to fly from Detroit with this little plane and land in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, within a 10-minute window, or we couldn't go in.
And how long is the flight?
4.5 hours.
Okay, right.
So you have to,
that's a challenge.
You have to leave yourself some time to circle around. But we landed a couple weeks after the earthquake, and there's no commercial planes were going in. And what I saw there was so devastating. I mean, it never leaves me. The people scrounging in the street for any crumb of food or water, drinking from dirty puddles, people covered in white dust, every building just a mountain of rubble, people climbing onto the rocks of rubble and looking for bodies. And I went into this orphanage, and it hadn't been destroyed, thank God, but it had been overrun, and it was in bad shape. And I started to come back. I came back the next month. I've been there literally every month since.
Since, yeah.
And a few months in, he admitted to me that he didn't have any money to run it. And in one of those moments that, you know, you look back in your life and you say, what was I thinking? I said to him, well, I could probably run this place. I've run some charities in Detroit. It can't be that much different. And he said, hallelujah. And that was it. And that was the last we saw of him. And I've been running it ever since.
I suppose people don't remember, but there was 250,000 people died in the earthquake?
In 45 seconds, more than 250,000 people were dead and more than 1 million homeless.
And before that, 70% of Haitians were below the poverty line.
Yeah, it's still that way today.
So it wasn't a good place to live.
Second poorest country in the world. Apparently, I've been surprised since I've been here in Ireland and England that people are taken aback by that, but I guess we live closer to it in the States, so we're a little more aware of it. But yeah, it's the second poorest country on the planet. Clean water, difficult for almost everybody. Transportation, non-existent out in the provinces. Electricity, even in Port-au-Prince, goes off at 7 o'clock at night, and you don't get it back until 6 in the morning.
Right.
So you're talking about a very challenged country to begin with, and then this terrible earthquake comes in.
Okay, so a lot of displaced people, a lot of orphaned children, because... Yeah. 250,000 people died. Right. So Chica, tell us your first encounter with little Chica. What age was she?
She was just before 3, and she was brought in by her godmother, and I was told that she had survived the earthquake. She was 3 days old when the earthquake hit, and the house that her and her mother were in was a little cinder block house. It collapsed around them, but somehow didn't hit them. and they survived it. And then 2 years later, her mother died in that same rebuilt cinder block house, giving birth to a baby brother because there was no doctor present. And there's never a doctor present for poor women in Haiti. They can't afford medical care. There's no hospitals. So she died. I can't even tell you what she died of. Mm. And Chica was taken away that day by the godmother and brought to us. And I remember when she sat on her godmother's lap. Normally, when kids are brought into us, they're very scared. It's an unusual place, and, you know, they don't know where they are. So they keep their head down. They very rarely say a word. Chica had her head up the whole time. She was staring at me with her arms crossed, like, how long is this going to take? Because I saw some kids out there with a soccer ball, and I really want to get out there. And at one point, she stuck her tongue out at me because I kept looking at her, and so I stuck my tongue out back. Right. And then she laughed, and then I laughed, and I said to myself, oh, this kid's brave. I didn't know how brave she would need to be.
Yeah, over the years. So then you were going back and forth and you had a sort of a lovely, it sounds like nearly Pied Piper relationship with all the children. When you arrived, they'd hang out with you. And
they still do.
You'd sing songs, tell yeah. stories, all of that.
Well, I operate the orphanage. I'm there every month for 4 or 5 days. The one thing I've learned, Ray, that you have to be with orphan children is consistent. You cannot pop into their lives and then be gone because their biggest phobia is being abandoned. Mm. And so they know I will be back every month. And if the first thing they ask me after they jump on me when I get there is, how long are you staying? And I say, well, I'll be here, you know, 4 days, 5 days. When are you coming back? Well, what month is it? May. Well, what comes after May? And if June. They know June, yes. Then I'll be back in June, right? Okay. And then they're all right. As long as they know that I'm going to come back. So, I mean, these kids are... What's interesting for me and my personal story is that we didn't have children of our own, my wife and I. We got married in our late 30s, and it just didn't happen. We tried, but...
You say in the book that it was... And you're very honest about it.
Yeah.
It was selfishness.
Well, it was selfishness getting married that late. And then I thought, you know, well, let's just wait a year or two. You know, we'll be married for a while. I don't want to have kids immediately. And I think there was that part of me that... I don't know if Irish men are like this, but a lot of American men are like this. They think... Oh, once we have kids, my wife's just going to be doting on the kids and I'll be the guy who takes the trash out, you know. And that was so stupid. I mean, I can't believe when I look back on that how immature and idiotic it was. Whatever good word fits it. Because once we had Chica in our life, I didn't lose my wife. I gained a whole other side of it.
So Chica got sick and you brought her to a doctor in Haiti.
Yeah.
And... this is a sort of a pivotal moment, isn't it? Where you're told that there's nobody in Haiti who can
deal
with
this. That
was the
diagnosis. Yeah, her face was starting to droop. She'd been with us for a few years, just a funny, loud, bossy kid. Everybody adored her because she was just so brash. Never an ounce of bad health. And then all of a sudden, her face started to droop. We took her to a doctor and they got an MRI, which there's only one MRI machine in the whole country. You have to wait for 6 hours, you have to bring $750 cash, and you just sit there until they take a picture. And when the picture was given to me, the report was two sentences. She has a mass on her brain, and whatever it is, there's nobody in Haiti who can help her. End of story. You know, so what do you do with that?
Yeah.
So we scrambled. We had to get her a birth certificate. We didn't have a birth certificate. We had to get a passport, and we had to get a visa. And luckily, we managed to pull that together, brought her to America, thought, well, our American medicine will... miraculously cure her. And
the legals around that, Mitch, you know, because you weren't her legal guardian.
Well, I was her legal guardian. Okay. Yeah. In Haiti, I was her legal guardian. Right. And so it transfers to America.
And you were her legal guardian because you ran the orphanage in which
resident. Well, when they don't have parents, so there's documents that you sign say the person who's running the orphanage becomes a legal guardian.
But now it's something different, isn't it, for you? Because you were visiting there 4 days a week, and that's a huge commitment.
Yeah.
But now you are bringing this little person into your world.
Right. And I remember the day that it all really changed because, you know, we brought her up before the surgery. She was there for a few weeks, and it was fun. She was in a bed at the foot of our bed, and we had this little five-year-old waking us up and saying, I have to go potty. And, you know, and for us, this was brand new, even though other people have gone through it many times. And we delighted in it. It was wonderful. And then they had the exploratory brain surgery. They went in. We thought, okay, they'll fix everything. They'll take everything out. They'll tell us how long she needs to recover, and we'll take her back to Haiti. And we walk into this consulting room, and the doctor sighs. And I thought to myself, that's not good. He sighed. And then he said, I have some rough news. She has something called DIPG, which is essentially a four-letter word for death. It only hits a couple of hundred kids a year, usually between 4 and 9. it's totally inoperable, totally unstoppable. And he said she'll probably be gone in within 4 months. What do you want to do? And I mean, we came into this room thinking, okay, we'll find out when we can take her home. And now we're finding she can die on our watch. And oh, what do we want to do? So I kind of chickened out the way a lot of people in that situation do. And I said, well, what would you do if it was your daughter? And he said, I would take her back to Haiti and let her play for a month or two. And then she'll become debilitated. She'll lose her walking, her speech, her swallowing very quickly, and she'll die. But at least she'll be at home, because don't bother with the stuff you're going to try. It's
not going to work.
It's not going to work, and it's going to affect her quality of life. And when he said the words quality of life, something like ticked in me and got angry a little bit. I said, wait a minute, where we're sitting in this very luxurious suburb in Michigan, United States, has no connection to quality of life as Chica had known it, without a bathroom, without running water, without electricity, sleeping in a bed of leaves when she was 3 days old for the next 6 weeks of her life outside under the stars because they didn't have a house. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. We're not going to take her home to Haiti and let her die. This kid is a fighter, and you don't know her. I do. And if she fights, we're going to fight. And he said, all right. And that began what turned out to be a 2-year journey, not 4 months. She outlived them five times over. And along the way, while we were searching for a cure, we found the family. And that's really what Finding Chica is about, more than it's not really about an illness. It's about how you make a family, you know.
And I said it's nonfiction, but there is an imagined conversation in it throughout.
I did that on purpose, Ray, because I know there are people who are afraid to even pick up a book if they hear it's about a dying child. You know, it's like, oh, that's too tough, I can't take it. And I certainly didn't want to create a book where you get towards the last 40, 50 pages and you go, I can't go on. I know she's going to, and I don't want to read.
I know, this ends. Yeah.
Yeah. So on the very first page, you find out that she died. I say it right off in the third paragraph. But you also find out that she's come back to me and she visits me and she talks to me. And amongst her talks, she says to me, well, what are you writing? And I said, whatever. And she said, why don't you write about me? When are you going to write about me? Write my story, which is exactly what Chica would say. And so the whole book is kind of done in this conversation with her. And since she was one of those kids that what she said was so much more enjoyable than even what she did, I thought I had to do that. And I think I take some of the horror out of it for people, because they say, well, it's okay. He's all right with it. He's talking to her. And so this isn't going to be all heartbreak.
And her personality shines through.
She's incredible.
That's one thing that shines through. And your and Janine's love for her and for each other shines through.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that would be my goal in writing a book about her. Here's the quickest. So what was she like? Here's the quickest thing I could say. Back of the car, she starts singing, Do a deer, an email deer. And we say, no, Chica, it's female. What? It's female deer, not email deer. No, it's my mouth. I can say what I want. That was Chica like in 20 seconds. Yeah. And everything with her was sort of like that.
But I'm intrigued because so you've an orphanage, and there are how many orphans?
52.
There? 52,
now.
Right. And then obviously Chica became sick, so that separates her from the others.
Yeah.
But the love thing, you went from being a carer, you know, a man responsible for an orphanage, responsible for this child, and then you became a father.
Yeah.
Did you feel that happening?
Yes.
Were there moments when...
There were many moments. The moment that we were walking across the street and she went from me saying, give me your hand, to her putting her hand in mine without my asking. I remember that one distinctly. The first couple months, we would say, I love you, Chica. You know, we put her to bed at night or things like that. And she would never say that back. And then one time I called on the phone and I was out of town and I called to say goodnight. And she was playing with my wife and she wanted to get off the phone. And I said, all right, Chica, I love you. She said, I love you too. And then she hung up. And I wanted to say to my wife, did you hear that? She said that, you know. Another time she was lying in bed and we put her to sleep. And she looked up at the two of us and she said very softly, how did you find me? And I thought it was such a sad question. I could only repeat it. I said, how did we find you? And she nodded her head. I said, you mean how did you come to us? And she nodded, but I think she kind of meant it the way that she asked it, because for orphans like her and a lot of our kids in our situations, they don't remember who brought them into the world. She had no real recollection of her mother. But they know they weren't born at the orphanage. So to them, it was sort of like we found them in some way. And in truth, we have a number of children who have been found. One was abandoned under a tree when he was 4 weeks old and was left to die there. And a woman found him and brought him to us. Another boy was left at a malnutrition clinic for 2 years. Somebody found him, brought him to us. So finding Chico was a little bit about that.
And in the book, it's things that you learned from Chica.
Right.
Wonder and things like that.
Yeah.
And you say at the end of the book, you know, we didn't lose a child. We gained.
Given one. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're a religious man.
I am.
Yeah. And throughout this, I was thinking, how do you reconcile, you know, a benevolent God with what you saw Chica go through? Do you know Stephen Fry?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, There's a program that used to be presented by one of our greatest broadcasters, and he died a couple of weeks ago, called Gabe Byrne. It was called The Meaning of Life. And what he did was he sat down with people and he asked them about their fate.
Yeah.
And then at the end, he had the big question. If you have a conversation with God,
right,
what do you say to him?
Right, right.
And nearly from the beginning of your book, his words, Stephen Fry's answer to that question, were ringing, going round and round in my head. And I better get it right here. I don't want to misquote him. He said, I'd say bone cancer in children. What's that about?
Yeah, well, brain cancer isn't a whole lot better.
Yes, and then how dare you? How dare you create a world to which there is such misery? That is not our fault. It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil.
Yeah. I don't hold with that.
Huh?
I don't hold with that.
But did it test your faith?
It did, of course.
Chica's fate, yeah.
Of course it tested my faith. And there were many times along the way where, you know, I would look up and say, what more do you want from this child? She endured an earthquake when she was 3 days old. She's been poor. She's known the abject poverty. She lost her mother. Her father abandoned her. Now she has brain cancer. What else? She's five. You know, why are you doing this to her? She's five. And if... I would love to say I got an answer, but I didn't get an answer. I still don't have an answer. And the only comfort that I can take in this, if you are someone of faith, is that it's still better to have somebody to ask the question to than to have nothing at all and believe there's no reason for anything existing at all. When you're a child, sometimes you ask your parents things and the answer is no, and you can't understand why on earth the answer is no. And you, until years later, it makes sense to you. Well, sometimes I guess you ask God these questions and the answer is no. You know, let her live and the answer is no. But would you rather not have your parents in your life and grown up without them because sometimes you didn't like the answer you got? And that's the way I sort of look at it.
So it's only 2.5 years now since Chica died.
Barely,
we haven't mentioned Janine at all, and you write an ode to Janine in one of the chapters and how strong she was throughout it all. And am I right in saying that you didn't really consult with Janine before you brought Chica?
Yeah, I have that habit of going out and doing things and then coming back and telling my wife what I did.
Sort of seeking a retention order of sorts.
She's a remarkable woman. And not only when I went to Haiti and then I came back, I said, well, I don't know quite how to tell you this, but I think I just took over the orphanage. And she was like, well, do you think we can do some good there? And I said, yeah. She said, well, then I guess we should do it. And with Chica, honestly, I never said to her, I'm going to need to bring her home. I said, Chica's sick, and I'm getting her passport and all this. And, you know, I just brought her and Janine just became a mother. I mean, it was instant. And the chapter that you're referencing, I talked about how stupid I was when I was younger, thinking, oh, I'm going to lose my wife in some way if we have children. Not only did I lose her, I got to see this whole other side, this rich, loving, warm side, this playful side of rocking Chica or singing with her or them going to the bathroom together and slamming the door on me and saying, privacy, please, no boys, you know. Or Chica would pull my wife's hair over her over her forehead and say, look, Mr. Mitch, we have the same hair. You know, all these little things that united them together. And it really pulled us together, too. Not at the beginning and not all along the way. I have to say that we read an article that said that like somewhere near 50% of people who lose a child end up getting divorced.
And you can understand that completely.
I can, yeah. Because there were stretches there when it started to get bad where we started to argue just because neither one of us had the answer. And because you're in it with this other person and you don't have the answer, you kind of take it out on them. Like, why don't you have the answer? And you start arguing over things like, don't let her eat that. Why can't she eat that? Because you shouldn't let her eat that. Well, why? You're not going to. And if she took the other side, then I take the other side. It's just to be contrary because you were so frustrated. And one time, it was Chica who taught us about this. One time we were having an argument, and it was in the hospital. She was in for something. And she said, hey, guys, what are you talking about? And we said, nothing, Chica, nothing. And she said, well, it sounds sad. So I came over to her, and I said, well, sometimes things are sad, Chica, but sometimes things are happy, too. You're something that's happy. You make us happy. And she started to cry. I said, why are you crying? And she said, because I don't know how to make you happy now. Uh-huh. And I realized that she was ingesting all of our fights and took it. Look, she was the sick one. Mm. And she was taking it on like, I need to make them happy. I need to do something funny or make a joke. And that's when I went to my wife and said, we have to stop this. And that was it.
And I suppose writing the book for you was therapeutic.
It was.
And what about Janine? How is she coping?
Yeah, it was therapeutic for her, too. I had to read it to her. But I broke it down into sort of seven lessons that she could, because she lived 7 years, so one big lesson. And we sort of agreed, Janine and I, on what those seven things were. And they include, like, how you change your time, you know, your value of time. And, you don't realize that, I say, a child is both an anchor and a set of wings. And it's true, and you don't understand that until a child's in your life. A sense of wonder, you know, that Chica would get us down in the snow or in the ground or with the worms or the pebbles, you know, that just amazing thing that a kid has that adults don't. And one of the biggest ones was at the end when she couldn't walk anymore and I had to carry her from place to place. I was her transportation, you know. And so we were sitting at the table coloring, and I looked at my watch. I realized I was late. And I said, Chica, I got to go. And she said, no, Mr. Mitch, stay and color with me. I said, Chica, I have to work. She said, Mr. Mitch, I have to play. I said, yeah, but it's not the same thing, Chica. This is my job. And she crossed her arms and she looked at me and she said, no, it's not. Your job is carrying me. Mm. And after I chuckled, I realized, boy, you know, I just shot right through me. I said, oh, my God, of course, that's my job. That should be my job. That's the biggest job I'll ever have. And, you know, what you carry kind of defines who you are. And I thought back on my life of how many years I had spent just carrying my papers and books and computers and bank accounts, and those things filled my arms. And now all of a sudden my job was to carry a child. And it's all of our jobs to carry our children. And if you're fortunate enough, as I have been, that you can help the poor children of the world, then you need to carry them too.
By coincidence, my 7-year-old son was feeling ill today, sick, and the school rang. Oh. And I was sitting down at home reading your book and he arrived back at 11:30 and I hugged him and I wouldn't let him go.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. That was a very meaningful hug. We hug every day, but some hugs are more meaningful than others. Yeah. A huge thank you from Mitch Albom. I used to be an avid reader, but over the years found I had less time and just stopped. However, a few months ago, I found a copy of The Timekeeper in a bookshop while I was buying a gift for someone else. The concept of the book caught my attention, so I bought it and started reading and just couldn't put it down. A wonderful book. I've since chain read all of Mitch's books and love them all. I've even got my friends reading his books. Thanks again for reintroducing me to the pleasure of reading. Best wishes. That's Kathy Desmond there.
Thank you, Kathy.
So it's like, looking back, we'll finish up there, but looking back in your life and that sort of, You thought that being a parent would hinder your career, and you admitted to selfishness in the book. And does that mean you have regrets?
Well, I guess I don't like to use the word regrets because Maury taught me when I was with him, you know, you don't go through your life regretting what you didn't do. And I think as long as I have been able to correct some of the things, they're not so much regrets as learnings, you know, mistakes that I made that I hopefully I've maybe, yeah, I would have liked to have figured it out earlier. But honestly, if we figure it all out when we're 19, what's left to learn? You know, you're just going to go through life perfect. I don't know anybody who does that. So
nobody's perfect. We know that. Yeah.
But I did learn that, you know, you can make a family a lot of different ways. And that was that's one of the big points I try to make in the book is, you know, there's a lot of people get very protective about, well, you know, you have to have your kids at a certain age or they have to look like you or they have to be. It's not true. You know, we were in our late 50s and suddenly we had a 5-year-old and we were in grandparents' bodies and we were having to be parents and she didn't look like us, didn't talk like us, but we could not have been more of a family. And I remember when we had to go live in Germany for a while because we traipsed all over the world trying to find a cure. And we were in this tiny little flat that we had to rent, much smaller than the house that we have in Michigan. And Chica loved it because she had the two of us to herself. That was her favorite thing, that we all had to sleep in one bed. It was like, it wasn't even a king bed. It was like a double. And we all fit. Fortunately, I'm not a big guy. Neither is my wife and neither was Chica. And she was in the middle of us. And she loved having the two of us around her. And she said, Mr. Mitch, Miss Janine, Mr. Nick, Mr. Mitch, Miss Janine, what? Kiss. Kiss, kiss, kiss. So we kind of, you know, made a little tower over her and we kissed and she clapped her hands and she said, now you can live happily ever after.
There you go.
Now that's a family, that little teepee and a little child and the child wishing for you, a sick child wishing for you to live happily ever after. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Finding Chica, a little girl in earthquake and the making of a family.
And can I just add, Ray, that all the money from this book goes to the orphanage.
Yes.
Please, I wouldn't want anybody to think that I'm exploiting this story or making money for myself. I wrote it so that there would be two reasons. One, that she would live on and people like you now and your listeners know who she was because she died much too soon and she doesn't get a chance to meet everybody, so I'm trying to introduce her. And two, all the money from this will go hopefully to build a new orphanage because we need a new building. It's 40 years old. And that will be her legacy for her brothers and her sisters.
What an amazing legacy. And you'll come into us when you're back and keep us updated on what's going on.
I'll be happy to.
Mitch, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank
you very much. Great to see you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.